Good afternoon and welcome to the regular briefing by Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito and the team from the Governor's Office, Lieutenant Governor's Office, and the administration with the Municipal Chief Executive Officers of Massachusetts to talk about COVID-19, the pandemic response, rebuilding our economy, reopening our economy, and all of the issues involved in the public health emergency. I'm Jeff Beckwith, the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Municipal Association, and the MMA is deeply grateful to the administration for asking us to serve as the platform host for what is their briefing to all of you as the administration works in partnership with local officials across the Commonwealth to protect our people from COVID-19 and to make sure that our economy and our businesses and all of our institutions are positioned to recover and thrive going forward. The format for this meeting will remain as it has been for our almost 40 meetings that we've held. We will be recording this webinar, and an audio recording of the webinar will be posted on the MMA website, along with a summary article, which will include links to all of the information that will be discussed here. So everyone will be able to get access to this information so that you can share it with your colleagues. When we do have time for questions, the questions will be administered through the chat function, not the raised hand function, but the chat function. And we'll do our best to answer all of the questions that come forward in the hour that we have. So at this point, it's my pleasure to turn the podium, the Zoom podium, over to Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito, who's been an outstanding partner for all of you throughout this entire crisis. And now we see light at the end of the tunnel, and the Lieutenant Governor is going to talk about that today. Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for your
leadership. Thank you, Jeff. 40 is a big number. We've gotten a lot done in the 40 sessions we've had together, and countless meetings in between to address a lot of the issues that have come up. many issues over the course of this past year. So I just big thank you for hosting these calls with us. I just want to start by saying thank you to everyone in your team. And I'd like to just give a big thank you to all of those on my team as well. We've got Lily Zarella, who's my chief of staff, and Jess Bellevue, who is helping with all matters municipal. We've got Sean Cronin from the Division of Local Services, whose household name in all your cities and town halls. And we've got the finance star power in Heath and Brendan. I understand they've been spending a lot of time with you talking about how the federal funds are flowing through and what they can be used for. There's no easy task there. And on the public health side, we have Dr. Madoff, who's an expert in the public health matters that we've been wrestling through. And of course, Jana Ferguson didn't really know what a regional collaborative would develop to be and has been a key part working with all your local boards of health to administer vaccine and other services. I also want to introduce Jose Delgado, who is our Western Mass director. His office is in Springfield, and I just putting a name and a face together with Jose comes formally from the city of Springfield, Mayor Sarno's office, and is a great resource for all of you there. So let's talk about the good things that are happening today. Before I get to the reopening announcement, and some of you might have obviously read some of the pieces of it in the news, or maybe even heard the governor's address just a short time ago. I'm going to go through it again with you and then be able to address questions and then do the necessary follow-up with all of you. But before getting there, really good news to highlight. And again, a thank you to all of you for doing your part, because as we all know, we have used a number of metrics to guide us throughout this process. You know, the drop in cases brings us to a 1.7% positivity rate, which is amazing. Hospitalizations are down to hundreds in our Commonwealth. And obviously vaccination is rolling out throughout the communities of our Commonwealth with 5.7 million total doses administered. That's a huge number. 2.3 million people of our Commonwealth fully vaccinated. That's terrific. You've got another 1.2 million who have received their first dose. And based upon our experiences here in the Commonwealth, the likelihood of getting a second dose to follow your first dose is very high. I just got mine last week. I have to share with you, it was an emotional experience for me. I went to my hometown regional collaborative in Worcester and saw some familiar faces, which was very comforting. And then to be literally at a table where I've been witnessing from a bit of a distance, these tables and many volunteers and people part of this process, and then to actually be sitting there to receive the dose was really an amazing moment I'll always remember. And it was emotional just thinking about what comes with that, right? And for so many people, experiencing that across our Commonwealth is really great. And I'm grateful for all of the effort that goes into that. We remain number one among our peer states for first and total doses administered. We're second among all states in terms of doses per capita. That's really important. We have the lowest rate of vaccine hesitancy, which is terrific. And our percentage of Black and Hispanic residents who have received at least one dose are both about double the national average. We're number four in the nation in terms of the percent of Black residents who've received at least one dose. Obviously, we have our mass vac sites, our regional collaboratives, our community health centers, our health systems, as well as now over 800 retail pharmacy sites all throughout our Commonwealth. That's CVS, Walgreens, Costco, Osco, whatever, all of those are sprinkled throughout. We have administered over 21 million tests. We continue to process about 100,000 tests per day. And on the vaccine front, we're looking at about 40 to 50,000 vaccines a day. So I'm going to just pause there and say thank you, right? Look how far we've come and why we're able to make those further announcements. And the one thing I would ask all of you to continue to really help us with is the messaging about getting the vaccine. You know, keep those messages out in the forefront, use your social media, just please keep that in the forefront as you continue to navigate all the other pressures of managing your municipality. We want to make sure that people understand the how and how why it is so important to get the vaccine. So all those measures have allowed us to reach another milestone in our reopening process. So it is so hard to believe that it was about a year ago on May 18th when we announced the first step in our four-phase reopening plan for the Commonwealth. And here we are almost a year later, getting to our final steps. So an amazing journey in between. So let me just walk through it, and then we can get some updates from Keith and Jana, and then go to you. So this comes with a few effective dates. What we've tried very hard to do with you is to not make something immediate, right? To give you a little bit of time to process it and to manage through it. So for the Department of Public Health folks, there's a number of things for you to take note of. Effective April 30th, which is this Friday, face coverings will only be required outside in public when it's not possible to socially distance or as required by a sector-specific guidance, such as an event guidance. Okay, so you always follow the specific guidance, but if you're outdoors, walking your dog, going to the mailbox, taking a walk in the park, and you can properly distance, you don't need to wear the face cover. Face coverings will remain required in all indoor public settings. So that is the first date to be made aware of. The next effective date is May 10th. We will reopen industries in step two of phase four. including, and I think in the chat, there was a question about this, amusement parks, theme parks, and outdoor water parks at 50%. They will be required to submit a safety plan to the Department of Public Health. Road races and other large outdoor organized group athletic events will also be permitted. We've learned a lot from race organizers around staggered starts to reduce the bunching at the beginning of a race and at the end of a race. So staggered starts will be required, and organizers will submit safety plans to either you, local board of health, if it's a smaller kind of race, the races that you see your 5K, your 10K, or walk for charity. If it's a larger event that is multi-municipal involved, the department can be a resource in reviewing safety plans. Youth and adult sport tournaments will be permitted for moderate and high-risk sports. That's good news for families that have athletes that compete at that level. And we're thrilled to see that happen again. Also effective May 10th, large venues such as indoor and outdoor stadiums, arenas, and ballparks will be permitted to increase capacity to 25%. That includes, you know, Fenway Park, Gillette Stadium, TD Garden, and yes, Polar Park in my hometown area of Worcester. Singing will be permitted indoors at performance venues and events, and there are strict distance requirements involved with that. So you'll be able to see those also on the website. Okay, next effective date is May 29th. Obviously, we'll continue to look at the trends, make sure everything is rolling up forward the way we anticipate. And on the 29th, the gatherings limit will increase to 200 people outdoors, indoors, 200 people indoors, and 250 people outdoors. This includes both public and private settings and event venues. Additional industries will be permitted to open, and restaurant guidance rules will be updated. May 29th, street festivals, parades, and agricultural festivals will be permitted to open, and safety plans will need to be submitted. We are going to work with you on these kinds of events, given the nature of them, and provide you with some guidance. And I'd like to follow up with you, Jeff, on what that should look like. Bars, beer gardens, breweries, wineries, and distilleries will be permitted to open and will be subject to the restaurant rules. You're familiar with the restaurant rules. It's seated service and 90-minute limit. The restaurant guidance will be updated as of May 29th to allow table party size to increase from 6 to 10. And so the rules that apply to a restaurant will apply the same to bars, beer gardens, breweries, wineries, and distilleries. There will no longer be a requirement that food be served at the time of ordering the alcohol. That's also an update and will apply the same to both categories. All right, so assuming everything continues to go along the way we anticipate, hospitalizations, COVID cases down, and more people participating in the vaccine program, effective August 1, all remaining industries will be permitted to open, and all sectors will be able to operate at 100% capacity with all industry restrictions lifted, ending. The gathering limit will be rescinded. DPH will still be issuing guidance as needed, including guidance to still require mask indoors. We see that as being a feature that will continue for a period of time to be determined. And there's also always this note that we've used throughout this past year. We'll watch the data, you know, we'll look at the numbers. And if the pace and this momentum continues, that August 1 date might be able to move to an earlier date and time. Okay. I think that's really important to just pause on for a moment, because as you, as municipal officials, think about your own operations and your city halls and town halls and all the buildings and places that come with that, We will work with you, and Jeff and I spoke about this earlier, on your transition plan. We would want you to be able to have that in place and make that as streamlined and efficient as possible for you, your employees, as well as your customers. And I would like to just remind you, at the same time we're managing all these different pieces of the of this effort, you need to continue to help your downtowns and main streets get back to what we love so much. And the Shared Streets and Spaces grant and the Destination Development Capital Grant programs are both accepting applications until May 21. So we can put those links up again and make sure that you're taking advantage of every dollar for your local businesses to get them back on solid footing. And many of you have submitted expressions of interest to us. It was an amazing uptake rate with some great ideas that you have about future and further economic opportunities in your communities. And the one-stop full application is open on May 3rd. So it's right around the corner, and you have from May 3rd until June 4th to submit your application to that one-stop portal that contains the 10 buckets of funding for your next project in your community. So why don't I just pause there, and we'll go back to this and give both Jaina, the public health side, and the finance side just a few minutes in terms of an update. We'll start with Heath.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Again, Heath Folly from ANF. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and to Jeff and all the folks from MMA for hosting us again. I'll do just three quick updates for folks. Make sure that you're sort of apprised of some of the things that are happening in the COVID-related federal funds space. First, as has been the case for several weeks now, we continue to eagerly await guidance from the U.S. Department of the Treasury related to the American Rescue Plan Act, the direct state and local aid resources that were included in that legislation. Treasury is administering those funds, and we have not yet received any indication about when they will publish that detailed program guidance about exactly how we can use those funds. But we anticipate that it's coming soon. Some may be aware that the first statutory deadline for beginning to distribute funds is coming up, 60 days after the enactment of the law is coming up in the next couple of weeks. So we expect to see sort of a flurry of activity in the next couple of weeks on that front. So I would encourage local leaders to be on the lookout for information from us and from the federal government as it relates to direct aid from the federal government. So we'll be in touch with folks on that. Also wanted to mention two federal programs administered by the federal government, the Small Business Administration, for particular industries that have been particularly hard hit by COVID. And so I wanted to make sure that folks are aware that these applications are out there and be circulating this information in their communities. First is the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. There's been some note of this in the press and in the media over the last several weeks, but the SBA.gov, the application for the Restaurant Revitalization Fund just opened last week. And so if you go to SBA.gov and then the Restaurant Revitalization Fund application is on there. There's a pretty broad set of potential applicants that can pursue funding through the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. Restaurants, food stands, food trucks, caterers, bakeries, breweries, wineries, distilleries, sort of a list of potential applicants. So I encourage people to take a look at that application or to circulate that application to to folks that may be interested in pursuing an application there. And then the other program that had sort of a bumpy rollout, but seems to be up and running appropriately now, is the Shuttered Venue Operators Grants. Another Small Business Administration business assistance program for live venue operators, theatrical producers, performing arts organizations, museum operators, et cetera. So the Shuttered Venue Operators Grants, I would also encourage folks to circulate that to potential eligible applicants in their communities as another potential resource to draw down some federal funds to help respond to the new environment created by COVID. So highlight those two programs, and then also put in another plug for the FEMA Public Assistance Reimbursement Grant Program. To the extent that you have eligible expenses for the FEMA PA program, the reimbursement rate, as you may know, has been changed to 100%. So full reimbursement for eligible costs. The certain costs that were previously ineligible are now eligible as a result of a recent update to the FEMA policy, especially related to PPE, certain cleaning and sanitation costs are now eligible for reimbursement. If you have not done so recently, I would encourage you to interact with your MEMA, Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency field rep about the FEMA PA process, investigate whether you are eligible or whether you have eligible costs, and then submit those costs. Another great way to bring in additional federal resources to support COVID response for your city and town, for the Commonwealth. It's a great way to bring in additional resources. So I highlight those things for you and then turn it back over to the Lieutenant Governor or Jaina. I'm not sure who's next.
Jaina, we'll go to you. Thank you, Heath.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thanks everybody for having us again. Appreciate this. I wanted to give you a couple of quick updates on both regional collaboratives. I know a lot of your communities are engaged in regional collaborative work, and also around homebound vaccine, if there's time for that. As you probably all heard, there was a pause on the use of the J&J vaccine. That pause has been lifted. During the time that was going on, we gave communities that had opted to do their own in-home vaccination the opportunity to order Moderna vaccine, which is the different vaccine formula, to resume the homebound kind of in-home vaccination efforts. While we were doing that, some communities did, about 25 communities opted to order a Moderna vaccine. And then, of course, as you all know, the FDA and CDC have lifted the pause for the J&J. We're hearing basically back from your communities that some of you want to continue to use the J&J that you'd already received, partly because there are fewer, there are fewer concerns about this now. Also, the one vaccine dose is easier to manage in some circumstances. And a few of you have opted to continue to use the Moderna. And so that flexibility is still open. So you should just let us know what your preference is for that. If you haven't already requested vaccine, we're happy to kind of meet your needs in that respect. In addition, on the state program, since the launch, we have received just over 14,500 total incoming calls into Mass Options. Mass Options is like the call center for the in-home vaccination program that's managed by the Commonwealth. They've also made over 2,000 outbound calls. This would be people whose names had been referred to consider whether or not they're eligible for in-home vaccination. And as we've mentioned in previous calls on this, we've have about there's a screening program to determine whether, you know, somebody's really eligible and to answer questions and things like that. Over 5,000 residents were determined to be eligible for the state vaccination program. Some of those folks were really in communities where local health departments were doing their own in-home vax. So those were referred. About 20% of callers went to the local health departments because they were appropriately to be referred back to your community, since you've chosen that you wanted to do these vaccinations for your residents. So about two-thirds really of eligible individuals the screened individuals are determined to be eligible. Everybody has now received a call to schedule their appointments. There was a little bit of a slowdown last week because the Commonwealth program was also trying to make a decision about, you know, restarting with the Moderna vaccine, but those vaccine appointments are going to start again. They started yesterday, I was looking forward. I've also lost a sense of time. So April 26th, those appointments started up again. So they're out, the vendors out doing the vaccines, done almost 1,000 vaccinations to date, and the rest of them are scheduled. Some of those individuals also would include eligible family members. As everybody knows now, everybody's eligible. So when the vaccine is made available to the homebound, if they're unvaccinated members of that household, they can be vaccinated at the same time for the people who would be able to receive either the Moderna or the J&J vaccine. That's still just for adults over 18. So everything is back in full swing, and there were, and as I mentioned, just an opportunity now for people to continue to decide whether or not you want to use the Moderna vaccine or J&J. So please do let us know. But those are fully operational. Also like to give you just kind of an update on the regional collaboratives. We were able to bring in two additional ones at the end of last week. So we have the Chicopee Vaccine Task Force, which includes a number of communities. It includes Chicopee, Holyoke. We have also South Hadley and Granby working with those communities. They, you all restarted to receive vaccine at the beginning of this week for setting up your vaccine appointments. And then we have a Bristol County regional collaborative that includes coverage really and participation from Taunton, Fall River, Dighton, Berkeley, Somerset, Swansea, and Attleboro. So quite a few communities also participating in that. We have a few more. We have four right now who are approved as regional collaboratives who are going through the process of getting onto the registration software. We're moving to Color as the name of the registration software. So that effort is actively underway with all of those programs. Once we're up and running and we have available vaccine, we'll be able to allocate vaccine to those collaboratives as well. So that's, you know, we're bringing on around like two approvals a week at this point. So we're moving through of it, but we of course are subject to the allocation of vaccine that we receive from the federal government. So that's always a limitation, but we're really hoping to be able to bring people in. Doing great work. Everybody is, you know, maintaining high administration rates. We know you're serving your communities as well as all people of the Commonwealth. So really appreciate all the investment of time and effort that your local health departments and other volunteers and other municipal, both employees and fire departments and everybody really working really hard on these regional collaboratives. I also got my vaccine at a regional collaborative, and it's just great to see that work. So thank you very much for that work. And that's it for me.
Jana, could I just say a very brief word about the J&J vaccine? Because I know there's a lot of concern about it. And I just, want to say I participated in the CDC meeting, the ACIP meeting, where this was discussed. And this was very carefully weighed. And the decision was that this vaccine is very safe and effective. And though there's small risks associated with almost everything we do. And the small risk associated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is really outweighed by the benefits that accrue, the prevention of illness and disease. And the new language that everybody will get when they, if they're offered a dose of the J&J vaccine, will specify that risk. And if people express concerns or are concerned about it, there are alternatives available for those, particularly the women under 50 who were really the only ones who had adverse events, this clotting disorder seen in the trials. So it constitutes a very small proportion of our vaccines here in Massachusetts, way less than 5%. And so, but it does play an important part for those who it's not easy to get a second dose to. And that's where we'll emphasize our allocation. So I just wanted to say those few words and I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you very much. And thank you all for your presentations and for the message. Of course, communities have been targeting the J&J for the homebound program and allowing the option of Moderna to deal with the communities that are the individuals who might be hesitant. It's a wonderful level of flexibility, and we thank you for that. There are a number of questions in the chat. We'll run through them. I think that we have time to get to them. Recognizing, Lieutenant Governor, that there will likely need to be some further clarifications, as there always has been throughout this process of reopening, regarding all of the granular questions that come in, since it's so hard to come up with a one-size-fits-all approach, given there are so many variations on a theme out there in our municipalities. The first question, and it was, if you post a question, please post it to the all panelists and attendees. The first question was to panelists, and you already answered it, Lieutenant Governor, which has to do with the status of outdoor water parks, and that they'll be able to reopen on May 10th with 50% capacity, filing a plan with the State Department of Public Health. So that's there's a local official from Wareham has been asking us about WaterWiz since the very beginning of this process, and he finally has his answer. So that's excellent. The next question is on, will places like beaches and splash pads get updated guidance, or are those going to remain in place until the August 1st deadline?
I think those are getting updated now through EEA.
Yeah, I'm happy to add a little bit more detail there. EEA is actually going through a process of rescinding some of their guidance. So things like mountain biking, beaches, parks, playgrounds, all of these open spaces, the guidance that was issued way back last May will actually be rescinded by the end of this week. And, they will post a link to the general business guidance that, talks about distancing and appropriate masking in the right places. But those guidance documents will actually go away, and there won't be specific rules for those places any longer.
Okay, that's important information. Thank you for the question.
We can let you, Jeff, know when that is posted so that you can send that out through your channels.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Yes, we will share that, and we appreciate that. That's good information because of all of these outdoor recreation programs, venues, and so on. Local officials will be looking for this information as quickly as possible. So thank you. Can you tell us when DPH will be announcing the awards for the PHE grants? We and our partner towns are very hopeful to improve and expand our public health efforts with this grant, and we understand it's supposed to start on May 1st.
I'll send that over to you, Jana. That sounds like good news.
It's such good news. yeah, we are very excited about this. Of course, we did talk about this, I think, in the previous call as well. This is money that was included in the budget for FY21 for shared services for public health departments. And we had a procurement process. We're just finalizing the announcements on that and hope to be able to share that information very soon.
Great, thank you. Question on indoor singing. I did notice in taking a look at the press release that you issued a little while ago that there would be some additional guidelines for allowing singing, but there would have to be particular steps taken for indoor singing performance venues and so on.
Yes, there are rules around distancing between performers and the distance between a performer and a patron in a theater. It's kind of easy to organize in terms of a stage and a first row. At an event like a wedding, there is a way to organize distancing so that singing can be allowed. And I believe those specific details are on the website, mass.gov reopening.
Yes, they'll be in the guidance document for theaters and performance venues, and other guidances like events and restaurants reference that document. It will be updated ahead of May 10th, and the distancing requirements that are currently in place for the outdoor singing that is allowed will be carried over to indoor settings.
Thank you. Here's a question for Heath and the finance folks. Can ARPA funding be used toward hazard pay for public safety frontline workers? And then could ARPA funding be used to fund mental health support for children in after-school programs? These would be nonprofit programs for children.
So the ARPA, the statute, spells out four eligible uses that we've talked about here before. The two sort of most relevant to this question are eligible use number one, which are the direct COVID-related costs, as well as the negative economic impacts of the responding to the negative economic impacts of COVID. And then the other one is the statute specifically allows for premium pay for designated workers working during the course of the pandemic. Hazard pay specifically isn't called out in the statute, and so we'll need more guidance from the US Treasury about the extent to which we can use ARPA funds for hazard pay. Many communities are familiar with the set of facts that surrounded hazard pay during the coronavirus relief fund, or over the last year with the coronavirus relief fund, in which it was an articulated eligible use in the guidance documents, but the compliance parameters around demonstrating that hazard pay was related to COVID and necessary related to COVID were really quite burdensome. So not only as we look forward to the U.S. Treasury guidance I mentioned, will we be looking for more information about what role the new funds will play vis-a-vis hazard pay. We'll also be looking for information about the compliance and how to administer hazard pay programs in our communities as we go forward. So much more to come on that in the course of the as the Treasury guidance comes out. But sort of answering your question sort of a sideways kind of way is that the statute does explicitly allow for premium pay. So you could offer premium pay to a designated eligible employee. So not hazard pay per se, but you could provide additional additional compensation for the work that somebody in that sort of setting is would be doing, and that's specifically called out in the statute.
And Heath, do you have a recollection as to whether or not that would be allowed retroactively or prospectively only for the future?
Right. So the covered period for the new ARPA funds is March 3rd, 2021. So, you could use the ARPA funds to pay for, in theory, you could pay for costs incurred between March 3rd, 2021 and December 31st, 2024. So there's, I suppose, a small period of retroactivity, but you certainly could not go back beyond March 3rd, 2021 for the use of the ARPA funds.
Right. And also, since this is intended to be sort of a bill to deal with, or an act to deal with the pandemic and then to help stimulate, a lot of retroactivity wouldn't really stimulate if So that's a MMA's suggestion would be to be looking forward with these funds. The next question was the use of mental Sean health. Oh, yes, Sean.
Can I just, there was a, just on the second part of that, the education piece.
Yes.
Folks should remember that there is a second round of extra funding that has already been authorized, and then the ARPA included a third round. So there's still guidance that needs to come from DESE on those, but I think that would be the more applicable funding source for any type of after-school or enhanced program, educational programs for students.
Yeah, that's Sean, thank you for raising that, because that gets to the whole idea of leveraging all of the funds in ARPA and the previous legislation and the economic development measures that you, Lieutenant Governor, have triggered. We would want to use the ARPA funds going forward, not to replace those, but to supplement, expand, and leverage. So ESSER funds are quite significant. And so looking at after-school programs, that would be the source of funds to look at, as opposed to the ARPA direct municipal aid. Also, just a note that that Jess from the governor's office has posted the governor and lieutenant governor's press release a couple of times during the chat. So just take a look at the chat function to get a direct link there. Here's another, this is an important question, Lieutenant Governor. It has to do with August 1st and whether that means that the emergency declaration that your administration issued would be expiring, or if it's the lifting of restrictions that would be occurring, because so many of the additional authorities that cities and towns have, for example, the virtual meetings, are coming from the declaration of the public emergency or in place through the emergency. And I know that we will be working closely with you on a transition for communities, but many communities want to continue their virtual meetings and continue those options. And then there are some other aspects of the additional flexibility given to communities that are set not for the public health emergency, but to a particular date. For example, the ability to use absentee ballots with greater flexibility through June 30th in municipal elections. That's date set. So there's a whole set of issues here, but if you could on the question of the public health emergency, what is the administration's thinking about the public health emergency and the duration of that?
Three things. What we announced today is a lifting of restrictions effective August 1, so that those impacted by these restrictions will no longer have those restrictions in place, and capacity will increase to 100%. That is a separate announcement from what we will ultimately determine to be the end of a state of emergency, which we have not made a decision on at this time. And the third piece I would say is it feels like a period of transition as we move forward through the phased reopening process, having reached the final step of phase four and increasing the gatherings number and other pieces to this, that we should be working directly with you around your transition plan and how we can guide you there. So three separate things: lifting of restrictions, 100% capacity for August 1, to be determined on the status of the state of emergency, and let's work on a transition plan for municipalities.
Thank you very much. And there are some very interesting developments that have occurred, a lot of learning. And so it may be that, for example, you co-chaired the reopening process, and the next stage after all of this is called the new normal, whatever that looks like. And right. It could be that for municipalities, the new normal, many would want to have the ability to opt into virtual meetings if they want, or continuation of the streamlined permitting process for outdoor dining and for liquor licenses and so on that have been very successful in standing up our businesses. And so we look forward to those discussions with you about the transition period and then what the new normal looks like, hopefully taking a lot of the positive lessons about what's worked over the course of the last year and being able to apply them going forward. So thank you for that very much.
We will have a small working group with Jeff to address what you anticipate these issues to be.
And we look forward to that. Thank you. The next question has to do with ESSER funds. When you filed your budget, Lieutenant Governor and the Governor, you included a provision that allowed cities and towns to use a portion of the ESSER funds to from ESSER II, I believe, to pay for the increase in the required local municipal contribution as the Student Opportunity Act is being implemented and Chapter 70 formula is being implemented. But that's not in the version of the budget that's before the House right now. So the question is whether or not Division of Local Services, DOR, DESE could come up with regulations as a way to clarify whether or not communities would still have that option, even if it's not in statute.
Mm-hmm. Sean, can you speak to that?
Sure. Well, I can speak to the DLS side of it. The answer is no. There's nothing we can do regulation-wise to make that change. I'll follow up with DESE to see if they have the legal authority to do so. But definitely no for Division of Local Services.
And do you know whether or not that would be, obviously that was an allowable use of ESSER funds because you would not have included that in House 1 in the proposed fiscal 22 budget. So if a school department wished to provide those funds, would that still need a legislative authority?
I think unless Heath has an answer right now, it's probably something we're going to have to double check and get back to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's about the, it's in the Chapter 70 calculation for, local contribution. I mean, that is the issue. And so we would need to follow up with DESE to see what they could do administratively. But I think the formula is set in statute.
Okay. We think it's a good idea to be able to work with you in the use of those funds and give you as much flexibility there as possible. We will follow up and give you a direct answer.
Thank you. We very much appreciated your including that provision and we'll continue to advocate for that in the final version of the budget, but it's always good to have a backup plan as well. The next question is, are there plans to revisit regulations to allow outdoor dining to continue once the emergency orders end?
Well, I would put that item, and we talked about this before on this call, I put that on our list to review because I think there are some steps that municipalities can take in order to incorporate that provision into your local zoning and permitting processes. And we would like to give you some guidance on that so that you're not caught without that option to offer to your local businesses that have seen some success with that program.
Thank you. Next question is, if the size of gatherings are being updated, does that also mean audience members at public meetings and hearings will fall under the 200-person indoor guidance?
I believe that municipal legislative bodies are exempt from the gathering order.
And then there, so communities would, exactly. So the town meeting, for example, is exempt from the gathering order. Communities may still wish to go forward with outdoor town meeting, whatever it is that they want during this transition period.
Yes, and they can proceed. Yes. Yeah.
Here's another question, and this gets to unique nature of the way that individual communities handle issues. This has to do with parade guidance that that many communities permit the parade based on the number of participants, but not the crowd, since the crowd is lining up on the sidewalk and so on. And it's really not possible for some communities to figure out how to reduce by 50% the number of people who go to watch a parade, especially if that number is in the thousands. And so it may be that while the guidance would include parades in there for practical purposes, many communities may decide not to hold parades in the meantime, just because of the inability to restrict crowds and so on. But any comments? I know we've had a very brief conversation about this, but this is one of those things.
Right. I mean, our intent is to see them proceed with some capacity restriction, although from a practical standpoint, that might be difficult to do. There is a permit usually involved in a festival, a parade, an agricultural event, and that permit could include a capacity restriction for, say, parade participants, but difficult to manage parade spectators if there isn't an ingress and an egress defined for that event. But we have time. That's what's helpful about not announcing something with an immediate effective date. We have some time to work through this with you to accomplish what makes sense. Knowing we're in this transition phase, we obviously don't want to put people in places where we could experience a COVID problem. So we need to be mindful of that as well. So let us take a little bit more time, knowing the direction we'd like to go, to work out this detail with you.
Thank you. And we appreciate the intent in recognizing also it's not a mandate that communities hold their parades, and it's not a mandate that the festivals occur. It's just that you're coming up with broad parameters and then trying to work out those details as they emerge.
And I think also knowing that August 1 is a date that triggers the lifting of restrictions and full capacity after that date, there's some local planning that might be involved with moving certain events to a time after August 1. You'll have to take that into consideration.
Right. And then I'm going to jump ahead and just take a specific question, which has, how will 50% capacity at street festivals be determined? And I believe that is based on the previous year's approved capacity.
Right. So if this is an annual event that involves a permit, in the permit, there's most likely a reference to capacity. And if there isn't, that's a gap or a vague area that we need to help you with.
Thank you. Jana, are there any community health centers which receive vaccines from the federal government participating in the color registration system? Our community health center did a great job reaching vulnerable populations, but is now struggling to register enough individuals to meet their vaccine supply.
Sure. So most of them are not, and that actually tends to be more related to the billing piece of it. However, some of them that are participating with regional collaboratives, in a couple of cases, the regional collaboratives are partnering with a clinical partner. That has been the case, but there's a transition. We would be happy to talk to that group about, you know, what it would take to move over. But it really, Color doesn't just register people for vaccine appointments. It's also a way of reporting vaccines, billing insurance companies and things like that. So there's a bit of data transfer. People have been administering doses so far.
Okay, thank you very much. And then, so the recommendation is to have the community health center call you. Right. And talk to you.
Send me an email. I'd be happy to connect them with the right team.
Right. I was not about to give your cell phone number out. Okay. I think we've taken that. Just in terms of the indoor capacity issue, what about municipal bodies that are not legislative in terms of the capacity limits indoors? I think generally there would be capacity limits that are occupancy limits that are set in the municipal buildings for a public hearing or something like that. But that's an interesting question. The community still, while the public health emergency is in place, does have the flexibility to be able to continue to hold those municipal sessions virtually until such time as there is not a a capacity or a restriction on the gathering of.
Lily, do you have anything more to add to that?
Yeah, I guess I would maybe just ask for a for instance, but I think it seems like, Jeff, as you said, it seems like the answer is really, it depends on what the activity is. You know, if you're having a community event in a municipal building or something like that, then yes, that is an event. But I think it would depend on what the activity is.
And then a request from one of our attendees, who's I understand through the grapevine moving over to the school side soon. It would be fantastic if someone could speak with the folks at FEMA and ask them to be a bit less challenging when dealing with local government requests for eligible reimbursements. As we approach the end of the fiscal year, they're looking to receive reimbursements that were submitted last fall quickly. So Heath, you and your team have been terrific, and Sean, but FEMA, they're still struggling for timely reimbursement. Any insights into that?
We can reach out in this specific instance and help make sure that things are sort of moving along in the FEMA process. I think we have worked well with MEMA, the state's sort of coordinating entity for FEMA PA, but sometimes there are sort of gaps in information that occur. So sometimes we can help move those things forward. But I don't know, Sean, if you want to talk to sort of the nature of accounting for FEMA reimbursements.
Yeah, the bottom line is it's not going to impact your free cash calculation if you don't have reimbursements and on time. I know there's always a lot of concern. We've said from day one that with all these different federal grant programs, now ARPA laid on top of everything, that we know that not all the reimbursements are going to be received in time from the federal government. Normally that would be, you know, a hit to your free cash. That's just not going to happen this fiscal year. So while I know you want the money as quickly as possible, don't be concerned about the impact on your free cash certification at the end of the fiscal year.
Thank you. It's very, very much appreciated, Sean. And I think comforting news for municipalities. And then the final question had to do with some examples of the municipal bodies or entities that would be potentially holding meetings or hearings, the Board of Health, the Planning Board, Conservation Commission. But again, communities would still, if they're concerned about significant crowd size, ability to space indoors and so on, would still have the option to hold those virtually during the public health emergency.
Well, there's two pieces, right? You have a public meeting, you have the members of the board, and the requirement for a quorum to physically be present to conduct the business of that board. That's what the governor's executive order lifted.
Yes.
To allow both the members of the board and the public participating in comments to do that all virtually. So the piece that can be impacted by the, for instance, the end of a state of emergency is that piece about the quorum for the board members to convene their meeting. That's what we should put on our list, obviously, to review with you. But that would go away with the state of emergency being lifted. The issue of public participation and having access to that meeting, there is no change in the law needed for that to continue for a resident to be able to participate in a meeting virtually as a member of the public, if the community wanted to make that an option.
Thank you. And this is, again, during the transition period and looking to working with you and with the legislature to make sure that there's a long path that with a lot of visibility toward that new normal, so communities can plan and implement and deal with all of these questions.
Well, that's what we need to discuss. Yes. Certain things that the municipality needs to do, certain things that the legislature could do, but there's time involved with the legislature passing at their level a matter through the House and the Senate and ultimately reaching us, and things that the state can do through executive order or regulation if we deem it appropriate.
So, well, thank you. We look forward to that during this transition period. Lots more to talk about as we go forward. Just a reminder to everyone, thank you, and thank you to Lieutenant Governor, to you and your whole team for participating and providing this briefing on a day with lots of new information out there for communities, and lots of good news in terms of the vaccine deployment and Massachusetts' status as a leader in the country. We look forward to continuing to work with you. The next briefing, we're now holding these every 3 weeks. So the next briefing, we're eyeing, I think it's May 18th. I will obviously send a note once we confirm all the date, the exact time and the details. We'll send out the information to all municipal officials. In the meantime, the recording of this update and a summary article of it with links to all the information referenced will be posted on the MMA website. Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much. I'll turn it over to you for the last words.
Thank you so much. Important milestones achieved today. I want to thank you all for your hard work. Obviously, keep messaging to your community about the availability of vaccine, how important it is to get into the vaccine program for your own health and safety. And there's a lot to process today relative to the further lifting of restrictions. And we look forward to working with you on those matters, as well as your own transition as a municipality, opening up more so to your workforce as well as to the public. Thank you all very much. Be well, be safe, and be vaccinated.
Yes. Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
See everyone. Bye.